Everybody knows Bluewood, at least the people that know Bluewood that come there, they come for the trees. And if you get 3-4 inches, you're going to have one of the most magical days in the trees that you've had in most other places. And I can't really explain it. It's not overly steep. There's nothing extreme about Bluewood, right? We don't have the big rocks and drops and all that, but it's just a fun day on the hill.
Welcome to the storm. I'm your host, Stuart Winchester, digging deep into that Pacific Northwest snowpack to find you some hidden treasure today in the form of your favorite little ski area that you probably haven't even been to yet. We'll swivel that spotlight right onto Bluewood in a moment. But first, I want to send a huge thank you to all of the paid subscribers of the Storm Skiing Journal and Podcast. Because of your support, The Storm is able to continually push out some of the most comprehensive reporting and analysis of the lift serve skiing world that's being published anywhere in North America today. And I want to underscore that point for anyone who's still on the free tier, but maybe considering an upgrade. I love the podcast. I have a ton of fun making it. But what you are listening to right now is just a small part of The Storm. To be frank, I'm a writer with a podcast, not a podcaster with a newsletter. And what that means is that if you're missing all the writing that's behind the paywall, you're really missing a big part of the conversation. And when you upgrade, you will not only see the 80% or so of written work that you're missing right now, but you will receive these podcasts 7 days early. You can upgrade your subscription at stormskiing.com. And hey, if you haven't even signed up for the free tier yet, you can do that at stormskiing.com as well. You can also follow The Storm on the X platform or Instagram at Stormski Journal. Before we get to Bluewood, a quick word from my sponsor, Profile Search International, the ski industry talent acquisition experts. Do you ever listen to this podcast and think, wow, that person that Stu is interviewing is brilliant, thoughtful, insightful, and funny? I wish they were running my ski area. Well, guess what? The team at Profile Search International has been placing leaders exactly like the ones that I interview all over the world, from the Sierra Nevadas to the Alps to Alaska to the Andes, for decades. They get it, and they can get it for you too. Think of Profile Search International as your expert boot fitter, but for ski area talent. For 30 years, they have been obsessed with finding the perfect fit for your strategic hiring requirements. Like a great boot fitter, they don't just strap you into any old boots or skis, they find the perfect pairs. If you want to build strong, accountable, strategic teams with the support and expert guidance from Profile Search, just reach out to them at profilesearch.com or hit me up and I will send you the details you need to get started. Go get the best talent for your special brand and places at profilesearch.com. Episode 170, Pete Korfiadis, General Manager of Bluewood, Washington. One day last winter, Doug Fish, founder of the Indy Pass, sent me a message out of nowhere telling me that he had just skied the best glades of his entire life. Within a week, I got a similarly unprompted message from Mark Galt, founder of the large and popular Ski the Northwest Facebook group. The glades at Bluewood were the real thing, he said, the best he'd ever skied. Now, these are two people whose opinions I hold in high regard, both because they ski a lot, and they ski a lot of different mountains. So when they both gushed over my favorite sort of terrain at the same small ski area within a couple of days of each other, they had my attention. That ski area, as you've probably guessed, was little out-of-the-way Bluewood, which, lodged in the corner of Southeast Washington, is one of the country's most isolated mountains. While Bluewood does draw a steady stream of skiers from the nearby Tri-Cities and Walla Walla, Washington, it's really not on the way to or from anything else, and not near any other ski areas. Meaning, outside of that immediate region, Bluewood has really been a mostly overlooked little gem. which means, of course, that it is exactly the kind of place so many of you are looking for, especially in what is generally a very congested corner of ski country. I had to learn more, and I'm telling you, you are going to love what you hear. Let's go. My guest today has been general manager of Bluewood, Washington since 2021. Bluewood features 355 skiable acres on a 1,125-foot vertical drop, served by two triple chairs and two carpets. Prior to taking the top job at Bluewood, he spent nearly a decade at Mammoth Mountain, most recently as Senior Director of Guest Experience. Pete Korfiadis is my guest. Pete, welcome to the storm. I am always so fired up to talk Pacific Northwest skiing because you have some of the most passionate skiers I have ever seen anywhere. I cannot wait to break down this special little mountain with you today. How are you doing on this Thursday morning, Pete?
Wonderful. Thank you for having me.
So I know it's been a little up and down out there in the Pacific Northwest, and you're closing this weekend. We're recording this for the listeners on April 4th. But how has the season gone overall at Bluewood now that you've had a chance to assess it as a whole?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably the same across the region, right? I mean, our revenue has a direct correlation to our snowpack levels. So snow was down, and obviously revenue was down, but it was a good season for Bluewood nonetheless. We remained profitable, and that's always key. So it's a bit of a proof of concept year, I suppose you could say, is, you know, to show the banks that we're going to need to be talking to here shortly about what we can do on a down snow year and our ability to maintain some sustainability, I suppose.
So really no surprise to you as someone who grew up skiing in Washington. Tell us a bit about growing up, where you skied, who you skied with.
Sure. I grew up in Wenatchee, Washington at Mission Ridge. My parents, it's funny, my parents did not ski. We just lived up that Schoolchuck Valley. And I think I had a bit too much energy. And they're like, we need to figure out something for this kid to do. So they dropped me off up there. And I still can remember my first lesson with Calvin Yamamoto, Yogi. And he's a legend in the ski industry. And, you know, stepping on a clock and figuring out how to use your edges. And for some reason, I just kind of fell in love with it. I had an older brother that was up there as well. And I just sort of kept trying to push to keep up with him. So that was it. Next thing you know, I found myself at the end of my driveway with my thumb out just saying, hey, can somebody give me a ride up to the ridge? You know, as like the 10-year-old kid. And then you just sort of become sort of the lodge mascot, if you will, just a young punk running around, you know, using it as the babysitter. But I just loved it. And so, you know, as I grew up at Mission, you know, next thing you know, I started ski racing, and Mission Ridge had a fairly strong academy back in the 80s. I'm sure most people will remember that. And then it sort of tapered off there a bit with the advent of snowmaking and other places and kids getting on snow early and academies and yada, yada, yada. Enter Greg Nidell, that came from the East Coast, from Stratton, and really turned our program around. He made the likes of, you know, Tom Rothrock, Lindsey Barksdale, Tova Paschkowski, and myself. I would put myself in that category a little bit. Those three all made the ski team, and I was close, but not quite there. And so that was a pretty formative piece of my childhood, just the ski racing component of it with Greg.
So it sounded like you were in it. And I have to say, coincidentally, my next Washington podcast coming up in a few weeks here is with Mission Ridge general manager Josh Jorgensen. I don't know how plugged in you are still with Mission Ridge today, but do you have anything you want to know? Any questions I should ask Josh?
Well, my whole life, there's been chat of that development down there just below Chack Chack. And, you know, that master plan that they put out there, it's awesome. I'd love to see that come to fruition. I mean, Mission and the Valley is ready for it and have been ready for it. It's just, I think they're up against some hurdles, and I hope that they can get over those and get that place to what it should and can be. Because once they go on their little expansion, that should be a force to reckon with.
Yeah, that'll be on my list to talk about with Josh for sure. So it sounds like you were in it at Mission Ridge and you were a big part of it. Did you ever actually work there, or was your first job in skiing somewhere else?
Well, I was a rental. So I was kind of a scholarship kid, right? In terms of team fees and whatnot. So I had to work those off. And so I did work in the rental shop and fit boots, you know, post my training session in the morning. And they were all just sort of gifts to me, right? They were trying to, you know, I suppose, teach me how to become a working person in society, which is fine. But that's the only work I did at Mission apart from the year I didn't make the ski team. I did start coaching there with the Mission Ridge team and was a coach there for 2 years. And that was post high school. So I did a PG year outside of the little college ski team, sort of fell through. That's a whole nother story, but we'll stay on the Mission side of things. And so I became the program director there after 2 years, purely out of just the fact that all the people that knew what they were doing left. And so they're like, well, I guess Pete can take over. And, you know, it's like, boy, I sure thought I knew what I was doing. But looking back at it, I didn't have a clue. I had no clue whatsoever.
So it sounds like skiing grabbed you right away, and Mission in particular. Did you decide then as a teenager that you wanted to work in skiing for life? Or did that just sort of happen in a different way? Can you take us through this?
Yeah, I think it happened in a totally different way. When I was done with skiing, I went back to, my dad lived in Seattle at that time and he was selling real estate. And I went back to Seattle and I lived with him, you know, a year out of high school. And I said, okay, well, I'm going to get a job in the big city and, you know, try to make a go out of it. And I was just too young for that. And so I did end up getting a job, believe it or not, this is hilarious, but I got a job selling cars at Eastside Chrysler Jeep in Bellevue.
Okay.
And I was selling cars there, and there's the 6 months later, I had a conversation with one of the general managers there at the dealership, and we were on the golf course, and he's like, hey, I was reading back on your resume and it says you were a pretty good skier. And I said, yeah. And he goes, yeah, I think you need to go back. And I go, are you firing me, Tony? And he's like, not really. You'll thank me later. And I'm like, what are you talking about? You know? And he's like, man, you came in here with just piss and vinegar and you're ready to take on the world. And here we are 6 months later. And I can tell that you're depressed and you need to find something different. And lo and behold, I got a call from Mission Ridge and was like, hey, would you come back and coach, for a year? And I got back and I mean, at the end of the day, the mountains are an addiction and you just find yourself in them. And no matter how much you want to leave, they'll just suck you right back in. And that's the beauty of it, honestly. Like, I don't find a negative to that. It's the best addiction we can have. But at the end of the day, it's like, if you're destined to play in the mountains, that's where you're going to end up.
So you're back at Mission, you're back home, Wenatchee, and, you know, no one would have blamed you for staying there, but you had to go out and explore the wider world. Take us from your return to Mission to Mammoth and how you got set up there.
Sure. So yeah, Greg Needell left Mission and went down to Mammoth and became the head coach there, head coach and eventually program director, head coach. And so I got a call from him that basically asked me to come down there and coach. And so I did two stints at Mammoth. I went down to Mammoth the first go around in 2000, I want to say. And I was there from 2000 to 2006. And during that time, I worked with, this will age me, but the J3s, and then eventually into the U18s and U21s, and became, I worked with the FIS team with, you probably know, Mark Brownlee. Mm-hmm. So Mark and I basically ran that program as Greg moved on to the US team. Then it became basically Mark and myself. And so we were at least the head coaches on the Alpine side. Mark will obviously tell you he was my boss, and I'll say that we worked together. but nonetheless, yeah, that's how that whole thing worked. And then in 2007, I got asked to go with the U.S. team. And so I worked with the men's Alpine team, first with the Europa Cup speed team. Then I went with 2 years with the World Cup speed team, 2 years with the World Cup tech team, and 1 year as the Europa Cup head coach. So, and that's that stint when we were living in Seattle and then also in New York when my wife was going to school, just kind of moving around, and she was solidifying her career path. And luckily enough for me, I could move anywhere and just home base, as long as it had an airport, as long, you know, you can home base out of anywhere. So it worked out. But then in that 2012, 2013, I want to say, season, I got a call from Mark. We actually met at Beaver Creek with Ron Cohen, believe it or not. Oh, wow. And we sat down and he said, why don't you come back to Mammoth? And that's what started my pathway into, you know, mountain management and event management. So I came back as the performance director, which, you know, thankful to those two. I think it was a bit of a made up job, but it got me back to Mammoth and just trying to bring that Mammoth ski and snowboard team to the its fullest ability. And then from there, I moved into the director of athletics and events. And at Mammoth, that events means everything. So we're talking from Grand Prix to bands at the Yodeler, right? So anything and everything. And when we were at the events, you know, there were mountain managers there, or one of them saying, why in the hell am I here so late when you're here? And I like, I don't know. You're the mountain manager. He's like, well, you should be one too. So they sort of brought me in as a junior mountain manager, if you will. So they didn't have to stay there till ungodly hours of the night trying to clean up from, you know, Night of Lights or the big shows that Mammoth is known for. So, and then that obviously just transferred into senior director of guest experience, right? And then also mountain management. So mountain managers at Mammoth always have that's kind of their secondary role. They have a primary role, and there's a team of generally 4 to 5 kind of fill it. There might be one or two that are like, yeah, I can take a shift. But of those, there's about 4 of us that took shifts and ran during the day, ran during the night type thing. So that was my deal.
I mean, Mammoth is such an interesting operation, and you were there during a really unique historical period. I've had Rusty Gregory, who I believe was running the mountain at the beginning of your tenure, at least on this podcast, a bunch of times. And he's gone into a lot of the history of Mammoth with us. But from 2000 to 2021, that period when you were there on and off, Mammoth started as an independent mountain. And I realize they own June and Big Bear and some other stuff. And then in 2017, it became part of Alterra. Kind of talk about that evolution, Pete, from your point of view. And I realize you weren't running the mountain or anything, but what was it like to be part of that big Wild West Mammoth that it was, and then to kind of see it corporatize over the years and then become part of Alterra? What was it like living through that?
That's a good question. I mean, I think you can go to any mountain, right? And you're gonna find older locals than you that are going to say, oh, I remember back in the day, and I remember when it was really good and really this and that and so forth, right? I don't think we're going to find a mountain that doesn't say like, well, it's really great now, now that we're about profit. I think the issue, and this is the hard part for people to understand, is you have to get to financial stability, right? Sustainability. And if you don't have that, then you're not going to be able to open your doors and keep the place going for the people that love it, right? And there's so much more than that. Like, there's the locals that, I mean, the town and the communities associated with it. I mean, I'm not saying anything different than I'm sure someone has prior to me, but like, that's a huge component of it. Like, we're, as a GM, the responsibility is like, we have to give people jobs, right? I mean, the profit is one thing, but like, at the end of the day, there's the whole community side of it. And, you know, obviously Alterra operates at a whole nother level that I'm not exposed to. But I will say that when I came to Mammoth, like, Rusty was like, Dave was still kicking around for sure. Yep. And he was like the legend. You know, I mean, everybody knows the legend of Dave McCoy, and there's massive amounts of respect there for sure. And it would be super cool to see him in the lodge. And, you know, like, our little ski team window was below his office, and he'd like kind of walk by the stairs and you're like, hey, there's Dave, you know, like, it was like that level of coolness. But at the same time, Rusty was running the place. And from a business side, I don't think it felt any different than when the Alterra shift came in. And the only thing I would say is that, Mammoth felt even cooler when Altero was formed, okay, because they used so many of you know, they took the best of the best from each mountain and put that collectively together. And maybe I'm talking out of school or maybe I'm not, but I feel it feels like they took a lot of what Mammoth did to formulate that sort of operating playbook for the rest of the mountains. Now, don't get me wrong, there were some great mountains that came out of Colorado and some good things that, you know, obviously Mammoth learned on in other avenues. But in terms of operators, you know, Mark would always say, well, Mammoth's the best operators in the country, the best operators in the country. And you're always thinking, okay, well, Mark, you're just blowing smoke, right? Like, thanks, we feel cool about that. But then my little experience outside of that is there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, Mammoth itself is a harsh, harsh climate to live in, right? I mean, you get 676 inches or what they have just last year, 700 odd inches. I mean, that's just disgusting, right? I mean, that's huge, mm-hmm. huge snow. And how do you place it? And where do you place it? And what do you do with it? And how do you keep things still operating in these massive storms that come through? I mean, there's not a lot of places that can do that, right? And so there's, in terms of snow placement and snow management and like the lift maintenance crews that could muscle through that stuff and get the place open. I mean, it's a war, it's a battle. And I personally, and obviously I'm biased to this, I haven't seen anybody else do it as well as Mammoth. But you'll have people from Palisades Tahoe say they do it better. But that's just the ski industry in itself, right? Everybody thinks they do it the best, but you can't argue that Mammoth weather hasn't been a proving grounds on so many levels, on so many different situations.
Oh yeah, I get stressed out just looking at the forecast they get there. Yeah. You know, yeah. Like not even having to deal with it or be anywhere near it, and just the multi-day storm shutdowns. So it sounded like Altera was a pretty smooth transition, because a lot of the folks running Altera were a lot of the folks running Mammoth, and I imagine they wanted to protect their baby. Curious from your point of view, what the impact of the Icon Pass was. It hit hard in some communities, Jackson Hole, Aspen, Big Sky. Mammoth, I'm curious about, it's kind of isolated. It has a very specific audience. I don't think it's much of a destination for folks from outside of California, at least not yet. And that's not to say that it shouldn't be. I just think it has this super regional market. So how did the Icon Pass change Mammoth, if it did, or was there really no impact at all?
I think you saw a change in visitation for sure. You know, they did that Icon Base Pass versus the Icon, you know, the Unlimited. That definitely changed the visitorship in terms of especially the Christmas holidays and the actual holidays. And what it did was actually level out the ridership. So instead of these monster days of 20 plus thousand people where the place just looks like a war zone after they all go home, you know, those numbers were in that sort of 16, 17 range, and that's very manageable. And there's a capacity at Mammoth. And again, I haven't been there in 4 years, right? So I'm sure my numbers are dated, and I'll probably get a call from Brownlee and he'll tell me, what are you doing talking about Mammoth? You know nothing about it. But at the end of the day is like, it has a capacity, right? And once you breach that capacity, the mountain definitely took a different turn. But I remember the first year of Icon where we'd have the locals come up to us and say, hey, is the mountain okay? It's not nearly as busy as it should be on this Christmas holiday. Hmm. And what it actually did was just sort of level that visitation across the whole time period and made it really manageable and made the mountain flow really well. Now, again, that was 5 years ago, so I can't necessarily speak to what it's done now, but I will say that the whole advent of those passes is good for the industry, but I think there's a few that would differ with me on that opinion.
So it sounds like you had a good thing going at Mammoth. You get this promotion, you're kind of moving your way up the ranks. You're part of Altera, which means you could move all over the country and have opportunities with their big portfolio. But you end up at Bluewood. So take us through this, Pete. How did that opportunity come up and why was it intriguing to you?
So, you know, we did the COVID move, right? I mean, my parents still lived up in Washington. My wife's parents lived up in Washington. We had two kids and we were both essential workforce. My wife working in healthcare, arguably more essential than myself. And that was kind of a part of it, right? So I was a finished carpenter slash framer before skiing became year round. And so, you know, we said, well, what are we going to do? We're going to drop 50% of our salary and figure out how to make money. And where are we going to go? Well, the first choice was Wenatchee, but then my dad called me and said, it's not the town you remember. and you should maybe not come here. And then my wife's hometown was Walla Walla, and we always loved Walla Walla. I mean, obviously it's blown up in the most recent decade with the wineries, and it's got a pretty cool little foodie scene, and, you know, it's old and there's cool little craftsman homes all over the place. And it's just a beautiful little town. So we said, let's do it. And I'm going to flip houses and just go with that. So we were all set up and ready to be volunteer ski coaches up at the mountain for that 21 ski season. And then the unfortunate incident with Kim took place where he had his heart attack and passed away on the mountain. And to which I knew nothing of this, right? Mm-hmm. But as I stated, my wife grew up here and she grew up ski racing at Bluewood. She skied for Whitman when they had a ski team. And so she also grew up with one of the owner's sons, Travis Stevenson, who was a mountain manager at Bluewood for a while there too. But he called his dad and said, hey, I don't know if you know this, but there's this guy from Mammoth there. It's Carolyn's husband. Maybe you want to reach out to him, because they were searching for a GM. And I mean, it was August, right? So they were coming up to a season. They didn't quite have somebody. And that's when it all sort of transpired. And, you know, I alluded to earlier, like the mountains are an addiction. There's no question about that. And so here we are. Like, I had no intent of going to be the GM of Bluewood. And sure enough, they just suck you right back in. So when the opportunity came up, I'm like, we got to do this, right? And Carolyn's like, yeah, I think so. So here we are, right? And I didn't want the job if they had somebody lined up to take it, right? Like, if there was a GM in development already, I didn't want to overstep that, because it's no way to come in and try to build a team on. And you know, at that stage, they said that they didn't. And so, yeah, I jumped at it.
So what did you find when you showed up there, Pete? I don't know how familiar you were with the ski area. I think you skied there as a little kid, but I don't know if you'd skied there as an adult. What sort of shape was the ski area in? And if you talk a little bit about, I'm not sure if you knew Kim personally, but kind of what he left behind in his legacy.
Sure. So, yeah, you're right. I did ski here as a kid. A couple of times, they do a little Buddy Warner race. So I remember being, you know, that 10, 12-year-old kid coming to do some ski racing. And I always remember a ton of snow, like high snow banks in places that you shouldn't, like more than Mission Ridge, right? That's just what I remember as a kid. And I'm not talking bad on Mission. I'm just saying, like, you were just like, where are we? Like, that's sort of what you felt, right? And then the mountain just kind of twists and turns and drops and dives. And it just has each little run has that, right? And so I always kind of felt lost too. Like, where am I? So that's what I remember as a kid. And then as I came, like, what it was it seemed like it was obviously lacking a bit of direction, right? I mean, they lost their GM and there really wasn't that next level to step up and say, okay, I'm ready to roll and take this. And I think what the mountain needed was just a lot of team building and a lot of, like, let's build the trust back up with me, right? And I want you to run with this. And there was a lot of development that needed to take place, right? It seemed a little bit flatline in terms of there's Kim and then there's the rest of the mountain. And since my time there, it's been important for me to develop the people at the mountain, that those full-timers that give their heart and soul to the place, like, we have to give them some accountability and responsibility and power to make the right calls and to not have to ask my permission for everything. I want them to think about it. And from there, then they can develop their quote unquote number two, right? Whoever that is. And now all of a sudden we start to put into place this bit of structure. And that's been the push. So what Kim left was the mountain was clean. It was up to date in terms of maintenance and ready to roll. However, it lacked that sort of big, big vision, right? It had an expansion plan in place, but it wasn't necessarily as cohesive as it could have been. So what we did was take a step back and reimagine what that was and look at the last master development plan that was in place in 2011, 2012, and sort of reevaluate what needed to be done there. And the first component of that was updating the master development plan. I'm sure you're familiar with master development plans, but essentially it's just a big wish list for the Forest Service, right? And the wish list was not big enough at Bluewood. So we reimagined what that could be. So we worked with the SE group, Pete Williams and crew out of there, and they were very instrumental in getting us on track in terms of the formatting and writing that stuff down. But I just kept saying, hey, we need to have this. We need to have that. We need to have this. Where's this? Where's that? And Pete was always met with, you know, I don't see why we couldn't ask for that. And it really worked out. And when I'm talking about this and that, I'm talking about, you know, a biomass plant, right? Like we are off the grid up there. We roll off of diesel generators. So let's get a biomass plant. Let's become the first fully off the grid, fully green mountain. And let's make that a goal. Like right now, you know, our only utilities that we use is diesel, right? Or that's our only cost on that, because we take the heat from the generators to heat the lodge. The generators are running the lights. We have a mineral oil sewer system that cycles zero gray water out of it, right? We only have black water that comes out. And so we are officially off the grid. Now, that's both cool and it also creates massive hurdles. Yeah. So it's like, hey, why can't we just build this up there? It's like, well, we don't have any power. So no matter whatever you do, you have to consider each component before you make a decision on that. Like in Mammoth, you could always just rely on power is going to be somewhere, right? The closest power grid that we have is 9 miles down the road, right? And they're not going to bring it up. So we have to figure that component out.
So I want to get into the master plan in a few minutes here, Pete. First, I have to ask, I don't know how many skier visits you do at Bluewood, and I don't know if you'll tell me, but I'm going to guess it's not 17,000 in a day. So what was that like to go from Mammoth, one of the busiest ski areas anywhere, with just this massive lift fleet, you ski into August a lot of years, it's just really well known, it's this California icon. What's it like? What was it like for you to go from that to Little Bluewood, which most people have not even ever heard of outside of Wenatchee or Walla Walla and the Tri-Cities?
You know, I put it to a lot of our crew up there in that all of the problems that happen in Mammoth happen at Bluewood just with considerably less zeros. is about how it rolls, right? I mean, Mammoth is its own, you said it earlier, right? Mammoth is its own little landlocked island, right? And the advent of the Bishop Airport, I'm sure, is probably helping the visitation there just because you can fly in on a little bit more regular basis. But I don't know. But Bluewood is in itself is its own little landlocked island. The closest lodging is 20 miles away. And so we got to figure out how to build lodging. You know, the power in itself provides a bit of issues, right? So at the end of the day, yeah, it is considerably less, right? It's a tenth of what they do on a day. But Mammoth Mountain is massive and has tons of staff, and they can spread the people around. Bluewood's a little more consolidated, so busy is still busy, right? So it still feels the same, like that sort of feeling in your gut to perform for your guests and your Bluewood family that comes up and rides with us to make sure that they have like that wonderful experience. That feeling's still the same. You know, you had it in Mammoth, you still have it in Bluewood.
So set this up for the listeners, if you could, Pete, because as you say, it's a little island out there. You're in Southeast Washington. Most of Washington's ski areas are either along the Cascade Crest or up near Spokane. So two questions about that. One is just talk a little bit about the weather and the kind of unique weather pattern you get there, because we know Washington gets a lot of snow, but like you said earlier, Mission Ridge gets a little bit less. So it seems as though you get 300 plus inches there at Bluewood. So what can you tell us about the mechanics of the weather? And then second, tell us about the ski culture in that region. Cause like I said, it's a little removed from everything else. So really curious about the passion for skiing that's out there in that little corner of Washington.
Yeah. It's a cool little drainage up the Touche River from out of Dayton. You know, we get a lot of storms coming out of Canada, and we obviously get that sort of West Coast hit that Snoqualmie, Alpental, and those guys get. There's going to be times where Mission is going to get more than Bluewood, right? Then there's going to, you know, we're in that little cell where 1 year Mission just kept getting all the little sneaker storms, you know, like those little 4 to 6 inches. And you're just like, where'd that come from? And they don't even know, right? But the year prior to that, like we were getting them all and they were drier. So it's a little bit of roll of the dice in terms of who's going to get the sneaker storms. But the beauty of Bluewood is everything is north facing. Right. So on low snow years, our hill still skis beautifully well. Everybody knows Bluewood, at least the people that know Bluewood that come there, they come for the trees. And if you get 3-4 inches, you're going to have one of the most magical days in the trees that you've had in most other places. And I can't really explain it. It's not overly steep. There's nothing extreme about Bluewood, right? We don't have the big rocks and drops and all that. But it's just a fun day on the hill. I put it almost to like mountain biking, right? Like you put me on a extreme mountain downhill mountain bike track and like I'll go down it. But now ask me at the bottom if I enjoyed it. Like, no, I didn't. I just scared the piss out of myself and I'm not that stoked on it, right? But you put me on a flowy kind of, ooh, I can jump here and ooh, I can, you know, go around this right. bank corner. And like, and at the end of that, I'm going to go, man, that was fun. And that's a lot of what Bluewood is like, right? Again, it's not overly steep. You know, there's not dramatic and drops and this and that, but it's just a fun hill. And like I said, you can be there 3 days later and still find a stash here and there. That's the cool part. So whoever set up the, and I have to go back and like check the actual history books on who literally put in the X marks the spot. But like that original Skyline Basin proposal that they had back in the late 60s into that kind of early 70s, they hit the mark for sure. So the snow's consistent, even on a low snow year, like we still have snow. We still had great powder days this season. I think our issue is geographically, we're 52 miles from the closest population base. And so if we don't get ourselves established into that routine of people going, hey, we're going to Bluewood. Hey, there's a lot of snow up in the Blues. We need to go check that out. Then I think that's what hurts our visitation the most.
So as far as those glades go, I mean, I've heard from multiple people unprompted that Bluewood is home to the best glade skiing they've ever had, which was surprising to me just because it's not that big of a mountain, 1100 vert or whatever, not that much acreage. There's a few things I think factoring into that. I mean, one, like you said, the terrain is just well set up for it. You also have a very deliberate partnership with the Forest Service. Can you talk about that and how those efforts have contributed to making those glades optimal places to ski?
So the Forest Service, when I first came in and started working with them, I was very pleased with their ability to just at least listen. And then at the end of that conversation, say, yeah, I don't see why we can't do this, right? They always go back to their forest plan and they say that, you know, there's nothing in the forest plan that doesn't say that we can't do this, right? It's been a massively positive relationship and one that I hope actually comes to fruition, right? I mean, it's easy to say yes, but at the end of the day, we still have a lot of environmental work to get through and make sure that, you know, this expansion plan that we have is ready to roll. But again, at the end of the day, like there's nothing that they say no to, at least at first, right? Which is great. The glades in itself, like to just speak about the trees. So like our entire boundary line is under a timber sale. And they came in, the Forest Service came in and marked all the trees that are meant to come out for the timber sale. And it should be up on the block this season. And there's an incredible amount of trees that are going to come out, which is only going to increase the ability to ski even better glades as those trees come out. And it's a bit of that forest rehealth program, right? So it's all the undergrowth, ladder fuel, if you will, anything under that 22-inch diameter program, 22-inch and above stays. So if right now there's like 7 blocks within our boundary line. So over the course of the next 5 years, all of that stuff is going to come out. And 5 years is the maximum. So my hope is that you've got a timber crew that comes in and says, I want all 5 of them. We're going to clear this one this year, that one next year, so forth and so on, and just work their way across the mountain. But if you are skiing around Bluewood right now, like if you did this season, you'll see that all the blue dots and all the blue dots are coming out, and it is going to transform that place again. So yeah, we're stoked on that part.
For folks who haven't skied there, just looking at the trail map, where on the mountain are these 7 zones approximately?
From boundary line to boundary line. Vintner's Ridge, that was pretty much left untouched. But from Vintner's basically over, it's all coming out. And again, because it is overgrown right now and you can pick your way through there and just like and rip through, and it's fun. And that might be part of the enjoyment of it. But when the trees come out, it's just going to open more and more lines throughout the whole area.
So help orient us to the glades here, Pete, because the trail map is pretty basic. If you show up at Bluewood for the first time, there's some kind of marked glade zones: Stump Farm, Champagne, Green Giant, Rated R, Alderon, Vintner's Ridge. What are the zones that folks have to make sure they hit? How do they get the most out of the glades? You said something to me before we started about traversing and that being an experience bust. So break this down for us as much as you can without making your locals mad about giving away the secrets.
Sure. I mean, my favorite is Rated R in Green Giant. Rated R gives you a lot of the fall line, and it takes you down into basically the bottom drainage of Green Giant. And the cool part about Green Giant is it literally is a little drainage. So it's got itself a little natural half pipe that all these little side hits start to form up, and you can give your best Scott Schmidt for those guys that know who that guy is, and just rip around in there. And it's just a lot of fun. If the cat is running, which is generally on the weekends, we'd have a little pickup point. It's about a 4-minute, 5-minute cat ride up to the top of Vintner's Ridge. And then there's some great hits in there, some of the best 10, 12 powder turns that you're going to get. And then you start to get into like the little trees and drainages down in there. And then that'll pop you out. And then you just get back to the lift and cycle back up. But Vintner's is definitely one. If you're a true local, you're going to get over into Manila Springs. And if you see on the map there, there's a little place called the Point of No Return. So that whole drainage over there, that whole area called Manila Springs, there's 1,500 undeveloped acres, and that's in our special use permit already. So that's our expansion. That's where we're going to grow into in time. And once we do that, we'll be a little force to reckon with. So that's the end goal, is to get into there and to get into there as quickly as possible. And what we would do is then we'd have basically 2 mountains that are tied together. So that Manila Springs would always and will always remain that sort of side country experience where there's not going to be clear cut runs. There's not going to be anything like that. There's still going to be a little element that you got to hike and earn it to get it. But nonetheless, we'll have lift access from low point to high point, and you just pick and choose your own adventure. And if you come to a rope line, don't go under it, because you're not going to get the lift on the way back out, right? So yeah, keep that side raw and keep it just like for the skiers and for the riders, and then do some work on our existing mountain, which is widen out our runs a little bit, make them a little bit more family friendly to those that are just beginning. So if you want all the skier services, if you will, in terms of rentals, in terms of ski school and the learning zone, you're going to go to the base area of Bluewood currently. And if you're a skier and you want to just go rip for the day, get over to Manila and we'll see you later type thing.
That all sounds incredible. And it sounds like you have big visions for the place. What is the ultimate potential of Bluewood? And as much as you can, just kind of sequence out for us the order that you see the ski area taking to get to that maximum potential.
So our current snowline crux, we need to get that taken care of. So sometimes on a lower snow year or even a later snow year, our snow line's about 50 feet above our base area, which does not necessarily make it the most optimal. And that's kind of what hurt us this season is we had snow. The best part about Bluewood is the summer grooming has been well looked after. So we can open on 12 inches and have all of our runs open. For the most part, mind you. Some will obviously ski better than others, but nonetheless, we can open with minuscule amounts of snow. The issue is that when the snow comes, it's going to be 50 feet above our base area. So we've got to take advantage of that November cold snap and start making some snow down there in the base area so that we can maintain our opening and get...
Do you have no snowmaking? I'm sorry to interrupt. Do you have no snowmaking right now?
No.
Oh, wow.
We're at the whim of Mother Nature. And if you talk to the old boys, like, she always comes. So it's not an issue. Historically, there were 2 years in a row that it didn't snow. And that was in 79 and 80, the year that it opened. And that's what caused the initial bankruptcy of the original. I can't speak if it was bankruptcy or if they just chose to sell it and get out of it. But the original Skyline Basin proposal was never actually taken to fruition because they had 2,000 homes up another drainage and a golf course, and it would be absolutely incredible. Like I applaud their vision for sure, but that just never came to. So the next owner that came in, then they started having just the successful snow years and seasons, and it worked out well. And since then, there's only been 2 years that it hasn't snowed per se. Now machines are a lot better. We can grab stashes from pockets and move it. And so our consistency with snowpack has improved, obviously, since technology has improved with snowcats. But nonetheless, we still have to get snowmaking in the base area. That's hopefully going to take place this off season. So we have an environmental push, right? So this is going to be our CE work for this spring. And that's going to be a lift replacement of the existing Skyline fixed grip triple. We want to move that to a high speed quad.
Wow.
We want to take at the top of the mountain, we're looking to put 15 overnight lodging zones in terms of tiny homes, if you will. So if you think kind of super Scandinavian style, very minimalist, but Instagrammable views at any point, like that's the big push for that. And that would be at the top of the mountain. So we'd have kind of like a tiny home village done up there, one looking towards the Wenahas and one looking back on the Touche Valley. And it'd be just an incredible place to hang out for the night. And then from there, we would move towards our kids' adventure center. So we're not reinventing the wheel, but a sort of gravity-fed pump track, a climbing wall. And then I'm working with the Whitman Outdoor School to produce basically a kids' outdoor school, right? So pick up kids in Walla Walla at 8 o'clock, drive them up, teach them how to build a shelter, how to climb a mountain, how to basically be outdoor enthusiasts. And at the end of the week, you stay the night in your shelter and head back home the next morning. So try to start getting that whole summer programming involved. We've got a little concert venue that we're building out as well. So essentially trying to eliminate the 6 month revenue drought. And then lastly, in that CE report would be the development of 6 different mountain bike trails. So once we have a detach, then we can start talking about loading bikes on it. So I'm working with the Evergreen Mountain Bike Alliance a little bit here and there. We're still obviously in production of scope of work and yada yada, but so far they've been great. And yeah, I look forward to it. So once we get that side off, then it'll be about obtaining the financing and charging, just going, sending it.
So for Bluewood to get a high speed quad, that's a pretty beefy lift. Are you looking to buy a new machine? Or are you looking to get one used from somewhere?
Well, I mean, everybody wants a shiny new car, right?
Right.
I would love to, right? Sometimes you're up against like what you can actually afford. And that's been a harsh reality for me to, I guess, wrap my hands around in that, you know, I wouldn't be opposed to a new lift, but if you take the North American lifts right now, they're only coming out because their pieces are crap, right?
Right.
Like you don't want to just go put your hands on, I don't know, the Sun Valley lift, what do they call it, Skyhawk or whatever, with Greyhawk. If somebody said to me, hey, pal, I've got a high-speed quad that's 10 years old that is coming out because we need to make this into a 6 or an 8-pack or shift it into a gondola, then that's something that I'd work with. Or if you had a lift manufacturer that said, yeah, we'll upgrade that one, we'll put our name behind it for sure. That's the thought process behind a used lift at Bluewood. But at the end of the day, you can't argue with the price. Like, it's generally better. But that's also our moneymaker. If that lift doesn't run, we're screwed. You know, I can't put you on the triple nickel and just say, okay, well, don't worry about your ticket price. Here's a quarter of the mountain. And, you know, at least you're still going up the hill. Like, that, you can't do that. So whatever lift we put there, we're going to have to make sure that it's reliable. We're going to have to make sure that it has uphill capacity and downhill capacity. And oftentimes when you're dealing with used lifts, you're starting to give up some of those things. So ultimately, I think if I could have it my way, it would be a mixture of debt and equity. You know, bring in an investor that wants to play a little part in Bluewood's success from a financial component, and just see what we can do with it.
So that would be absolutely transformative to have a high speed lift. Anytime you get over 1,000 vertical feet, that really changes the way people think about a mountain and cuts that ride time in half really easily. After you do that, where are you thinking about future lifts? I've seen plans for a lift up Vintner's Ridge. There's also all that acreage you just referred to, sort of Looker's Right over there. What's the full build out of the lift system as you see it? Where could you go after you replace the Summit lift?
Okay, so this is the one that's still a little bit in development, right? And so the neat part about Vintner's Ridge is kind of the cat ride experience itself, right? So you load up in the back of the cat, it takes you up there, and it's a 4-minute little jaunt up the hill, and then you go. And so you say to yourself, well, we need to get into Manila. That's going to open up a lot more terrain, right? So the question is, do you just leave Vintner's as is and get into Manila? Or do you focus in on Vintner's itself with a lift and then focus in Manila? So I keep going back and forth with this. If the original cut that you can see on the map there, it's not the best skiing pod, in that if you were to go where some of the good stuff in Vintner's is, you'd end up below the actual loading terminal of that Vintner's lift, the one that they originally had planned. And so what we would do is shift that more of a diagonal lift rather than fall line. And so even though you're skiing fall line, you would be able to get back to the bottom terminal. So with Vintner's, you can go from that sort of, what would that be, north facing, so west facing slope, and you can go all the way around to that south facing slope. So we'd have to figure out where that bottom loading terminal would be at the bottom of that south facing slope. And that's on the Tamarack Road. And so that's where that lift would be right there all the way to the high point. So low point to high point in Vintner's. And then the next one would be into Manila itself. And that would be basically another skyline lift. So I'd anticipate at least a 4,000 foot rope on it. It'd be a high speed quad again. It'd be close to 11. It's more 1,000 feet of vertical. And that's where you would go. And then once you're there, then you have to start thinking about all of the other hiccups that come with that, right? You've got 20, maybe 40% more ridership with two new high speed quads, and you've got the same number of toilets. So we better figure out how to deal with that. And then, can we increase lodging, and what's our power demands going to be, and our parking demands? And there's a lot to think about before we get into Manila. And I think the important part is just making sure that your mountain is set up for the increased capacity before you build. because you sure as hell don't want to get yourself in a hiccup where you're like, hey, we don't have enough toilets. No.
So you have big plans, and I think anyone who's a regular Bluewood skier is probably coming out of their shoes right now with excitement. You can't have big plans happen without owners who are aligned, though, right? So what can you tell us, Pete, about who owns Bluewood and how locked in they are to this vision as opposed to maybe you're trying to sell them on it?
So the original owners in 2011 that took over from Stan and Nancy Goodell, that was Mike Stevenson, Kirk Bear, and Greg Crawford. Since then, there's been a sort of, I don't know how you call it, a transition of equity just based on Greg and Kirk and Mike's desire to sort of eliminate their risk with the ski area, right? Just based on age, if you will. So enter in the two new primary stakeholders. You've got Chris Hallett and Buck Lewis, and they're both guys from the West Side, and they're very vested in Bluewood and the ultimate success of it. They're not, and maybe I'm talking too much out of school here, but they don't have huge amounts of cash. And so that's both good and bad. Like, good because they really want the success of Bluewood and they've put their heart and soul into it. And then in terms of alignment, they absolutely want the vision that has been spoken of. So the bad part is I can't just say, hey, give me a $20 million check and we can do all this. Right? That would make life a lot easier, right? So we have to think a little bit outside of the box. We have to be a little bit more patient than say, I want to be, but that's always been the case with me because it could be so awesome. It could really be unbelievable, and they know it, and everybody knows it. It's just, you got to get here and see it first.
Yeah. One thing that I've noticed with Washington is it's a growing state, growing numbers of people, growing numbers of wealth. And there's just not enough ski areas, and it's basically impossible to build new ski areas. So if you could expand Bluewood, it seems like, especially being the only ski area in your neighborhood, there is a lot of potential there. I'm curious about something that you said earlier about building those little hutlets or whatever on the summit. Do you own some of this land? Because my general understanding is that you can't build that sort of thing on Forest Service land. Correct me if I'm wrong. But just talk a little bit more about that project and maybe some other potential you have to build out a bed base there at Bluewood, since you are a bit of a drive from everything.
Yeah. So the way it's been explained to me is, again, going back to that forest plan, there's not anything in precisely the Umatilla, at least in our zone, where you can't have that. There's also another thing which is could be considered a lodging desert, right? We don't have lodging within that 20-mile radius of us. These would not be for sale. They would only be nightly rentals. Yeah, so I'm hopeful that that goes through. That's a big push. That's going to be the additional revenue chain we need to enable us to comfortably afford that $8 million lift or whatever it's going to be when we finally pull the trigger on that. So that's what we've got to get going on.
It seems like another potential growth path for you, Pete, might be night skiing. And they have huge night skiing operations at Summit of Snoqualmie and Stevens Pass in Mount Spokane. And you were talking earlier about really building out your bus program and starting to bus kids over. Curious if you've explored night skiing, if that's a possibility for Bluewood.
It's definitely a possibility. We were going to run some test events this year, actually. Granted, it would have been sort of junkyard construction lights set up on pads, you know, type thing, and just see if there was some buy-in for a couple of weekends. Unfortunately, where we were going to do it, the snow was a little bit low. And so building out, you know, a pad to accommodate that was going to be harder than anticipated. Not to mention we were going to do it in conjunction with some park and night events and make it something to see if we could draw some folks up. But yeah, it's definitely part of it. And it's definitely part of the plan. The hard part right now is our power demand. And granted, I know that the infrastructure's gotten considerably better with the LED lights. And there's even wireless remote lights out there now. So yeah, it's part of it. And that's something that we need to explore. But again, I want to do a couple of test events and see what the ridership is on that. And I'd also want to talk with Josh a little bit. I know Mission back in the day was like, are we going to have you know, night skiing, and and they've lit up considerably more of the mountain now. So I'd love to know more from him on how that's worked for his mountain.
Interesting about running entirely on diesel. I have to imagine that gets logistically complicated and expensive. Let's go back to that biomass plant you mentioned earlier. Where are you with that? Are you in the planning stages? Are you actually starting to build it? And when you say biomass, what do you mean by that? What will actually be the fuel?
Yeah. So a company out of Portland, Wisewood Energy, we started very early conversations with them about essentially creating a microgrid. The issue is obviously cost, right? And the cool thing is plants like that qualify for government funding and subsidies and grants. And so in doing so, we would probably be able to take a $5 million project and get that down into, you know, dare I say, $1 million, right? Because you get half funding from the federal government and then matched up with state funding. So it would be a process, to say the least, and it would be difficult to say, okay, yeah, we're going to do this until we actually had the funding from the state and federal already guaranteed. And obviously the amount of money is definitely a sliding scale based on whatever political administration is in at the time. So what it would do is it's essentially a generator stack that works off of burning wood, right? But the beauty of it is it burns all of the scrap wood, like anything that is not going to go to a mill, anything that is not usable. It's basically like, send us the junk and we'll chip it and dry it, and then we can use it for energy. The cool part about it, I mean, it still have a little bit of a diesel startup until the plant actually fires. So you still will have, it's not 100%, but it's pretty darn close. And each year technology just keeps getting better in that sector, in conjunction with the potential of solar panels and battery power and storage, et cetera. So there's a way to do it. We just need to keep exploring it. And once we have a bit of a bank account that says, yeah, this is something that we can explore, then we should do it.
Lots of cool ideas. And it seems like you're doing a lot of things to try and grow the business. One thing you did shortly after arriving is put Bluewood on the Indy Pass. Take us into that decision here, Pete. Why did you join the Indy Pass? And a couple of years in, how happy are you with that product?
To me, the question was, why weren't we on it already? Right? Like, I love the whole Indy Pass, Indy Revolution, that sort of spirit and soul of skiing, if you will. I mean, it's what I grew up in. It's what I know. And it's everything that Bluewood is like, it is like that indie mom and pop shop where you're going to get a delicious $9 cheeseburger and, you know, a badass bottle of Walla Walla wine. You know, like, our wine library is better than most anybody's. Like, bring it on, Aspen, what do you got? You know, no, just joking. But we also, you know, like, we've got local craft brewers here too. So we've got our breweries represented. We've got our wineries represented as well, which is cool. But yeah, I mean, for me, our mountain was not at capacity by any means. So why not bring in more people? And I was brought on to the whole deal of, well, we just don't have internet. Well, we've got internet and we can make it work. So this is definitely something that I want to be a part of. And I feel like if you look at, like you alluded to it earlier, right, with Jackson and these overcrowded and, you know, quote unquote, epic lines. And although that Instagram page got taken down, so I'm sure there were some discussions behind the scenes. But long story short, there's going to be some folks that are going to go, you know what, I want to find a better experience that isn't all the glitz and glam that the big mountains are, right? At the end of the day, kids still want to go to Disneyland. Like, they're not going away. But you can also take them to a smaller carnival and have fun too.
Yeah. So ideally, a product like Indy Pass would help people discover Bluewood, right? And obviously some locals are going to find some appeal in it. But are you seeing that? Because you are kind of out there and not necessarily close to another Indy Pass ski area, but are you seeing folks, for example, as they drive between Mission Ridge and Brundage and Tamarack, maybe stopping in to Bluewood just to see what it's all about? Are you seeing that? Or or are you still ramping up?
Yeah, we're starting to see us being one of the stops, right? Like, by no means do we have an enormous amount of visitation on the Indy Pass, right? Mm-hmm. But definitely starting to see a couple. My buddy from high school, right? Like, he's got an Indy Pass and he swung in and stayed in the parking lot for $10, right? And he's like, yeah, I'm off to Brundage tomorrow. So, he and I took some laps on the day, and then he stayed in the camper and off he went to Brundage the next day after skiing. So yeah, you're starting to see Bluewood put in the rotation, if you will. And I think our West Side presence is growing for sure. But again, you have to pass quite a few places to come see us before you get to us. So our population base is the Tri-Cities, right? I mean, that's the big draw. Walla Walla, obviously, as well. But Pasco, Richland, and Kennewick is one of the fastest growing cities in Washington. So that's been a help for our visitation.
Just talk a little bit about the ski culture there in the Tri-Cities and in Walla Walla. I mean, they just have that one ski area. Has that been enough to build what you would call a ski culture like you might have at Mammoth? Is there a deep passion for it there? Is it more just the hardcore that come out to your hill? You know, talk about it as a ski region for a minute.
I mean, the Northwest is definitely just filled with hardcore, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
What was that Safeco commercial when they, I think it was Safeco, the insurance, when, you know, we're just a little bit different with our socks and sandals and the whole situation. Like that's definitely our programming for sure. We definitely have our hardcore loyalists, right? We've got about 2,000 pass holders and they're up there a lot. You know, we are in their rotation. We get a lot of the ticket holders from Tri-Cities, like just coming to check it out and see it. I would say that our user base on the whole is somewhat inexperienced, right? That's why we have to do some education in terms of like, stop traversing in the powder, you go downhill, right? Like it's those little things where, you know, like you look at the user base at Mammoth and Palisades and these bigger resorts where all the folks are, you know, sending backies off of everything. Like that's not quite where we are. We're very much in development of our park, of our little junior ski team, our snowboard team that we want to start. I mean, we're in the development and beginning stages of a lot, but at the end of the day, like everybody has a pretty kick-ass time. So that's fun.
So you have a nice little season pass base, actually 2000 folks. And you have a benefit. I'm not sure if this is new this year, but I've been seeing it with more and more ski areas just suddenly popping up, which is free friends and family tickets. I think it maybe is two that comes with the season pass, but talk about this benefit, whether it's new this year and why you started offering this to your season pass holders.
Yeah. When I first got here, our season pass base was not that. It was more around that 775, 800 range. And I don't like coming into the season on a hope and a prayer that the ticket holders are going to come, right? I grew up in the school that if you have your passes, it's more of an operating capital and creates a little more sustainability and stability. So that was the big push, was to figure out why people aren't buying passes, what's going on there. So we did it as an incentive. It's a perk. That's what it is. And also expose, you know, nobody wants to ride by themselves. So bring a friend or bring a buddy up, get them hooked on it. And now you've got a carpool buddy to come up with you. And can we transfer those friends and family passes into season pass holders and grow that user base, right? And also, you know, I think a lot of mountains do a good job of providing value for your ticket holders, but oftentimes you miss the mark on your season pass holders. And I will say that Mammoth does a pretty darn good job of providing those season pass perks, or at least did prior to the Icon side of things. And so that's sort of what I guess my mindset was how do we bring value to our season pass holders? Because those are the guys that are going to come up on the low snow years. And those are the guys that are going to keep the doors open when everybody else has decided to go somewhere else to play, right? So yeah, they have to be acknowledged in terms of their presence on the mountain.
I mean, it's such an awesome benefit because I think it's such a buzzkill if, for example, you have an Icon pass and your buddy doesn't. And what are you going to ask them to go spend $275 on a 1 day lift ticket? So the ability to be able to bring someone along, and then, like you said, the probability of converting them to pass holder is just awesome. Another benefit you have is reciprocal partnerships, 2 days each for your season pass holders at 49 North, Anthony Lakes, Loop Loop, Mount Ashland, Mount Shasta, and White Pass, and then discounts at Lookout Pass and Mount Washington Alpine. We're seeing a little bit of, I want to say fading of reciprocal agreements, but I think some mountains like Brundage and Powder Mountain have stepped away from them in favor of the Indy Pass or other coalitions. Talk about the importance of those to your pass holder base and just that ability to go to a place like White Pass. It gets 400 inches of snow a year and has this great terrain.
I mean, it's just that, right? Exposing our pass holders to other mountains, right? And like, we have 2,000 of them. I know most of them by name at this stage, right? It being three years in. And because we're a mom and pop, like, we are very approachable. So there's lots of people that'll go away and go, oh, I was just at White Pass and these guys do this. We should do that. And sometimes it's like, hey, we actually should do that. And sometimes it's like, meh, we can't do that. Right. And again, getting back to value for the pass, right? That's just really what it is. Like, if you were to break down the reciprocal numbers, really the big exchange is between White Pass and Bluewood, right? We get a couple of people going up to 49. We get a couple of people going to Lookout. Those numbers were quite a bit more because all of our ski teams had races at Lookout. And so all the parents would use them up there, but then they decided to put some blackout dates on it. So at the end of the day, it's like, yeah, it's cool if you use it the way they're supposed to be, which is, hey, go get exposure at a different mountain, see different things and understand. Maybe they're going to say, hey, there's no place better than Bluewood, right? But at the end of the day, it's trying to, again, bring value to that season pass holder and say, hey, you get all of this for $499. Like, are you kidding me? Like, it's asinine, our prices. But, you know, we have to stay true to who we are. Like, we've got a fixed grip triple, man. We can't blow it up until that lift starts sending you up the hill quicker.
Yeah, know who you are and what you can ask for. Even the folks who aren't season pass holders, though, Pete, and this is the last question I have for you today. I mean, you can come ski at Bluewood. The highest price I'm seeing on your website is $66 for an adult weekend lift ticket. I think you kind of use some kind of dynamic pricing, so I don't really know what the range is throughout the season. But just talk about your philosophy behind lift ticket pricing and what you're doing to make that place stay welcoming and affordable.
I mean, unfortunately, there isn't dynamic pricing on that.
Okay.
So we are $66. You know, we went to the Intabeni system, so that does, there is a $5 add-on to that. So technically you're at 71 plus tax for, you know, weekends and holidays. And as an adult, again, it's just staying true to your identity. We can't go and charge the $85, the $90. You know, we're not there. We have to understand, like, what our value is. Is our value is our mom and pop feel to the mountain. It's the ability to, yeah, you're going to have to maybe wait in line for 10, 12 minutes on a super busy weekend day. But the best part about it is those runs are not overcrowded at all. So that's the big hang up is I get some of the locals going, hey, don't put a high speed in. You're just going to ruin the mountain. I'm like, not really. Our mountain has a ton of capacity. Like, if I'm skiing and I still ski pretty fast, you know, I might pass one group ahead of me on my way down the mountain, right? But in general, you can be looking around and there's no one around you because either they're all stashed up in the trees and you can't see them, or, you know, if the groomers are on point, there's just not enough folks to overcrowd it. So it's just it's a magical little place with that. But at the end of the day, we do have to stay true to value for money, right? That's how we're going to get people to come up, you know, and it's been a long journey. When I first got there, the tickets were $40, right? But there wasn't any sort of financial stability to that. So we had to increase the lift prices mainly because, and I'm sure you've heard this, like, obviously inflation just screwed us all, right? Food costs, gasoline costs, or diesel costs, everything has tripled. Hell, insurance has doubled, right? I mean, insurance for a little mountain is an absolute killer. like an absolute killer, which is brutal for us, right? And so that's why we had to increase our ticket prices. But at the end of the day, I have to look and go, would I be okay, you know, spending this money for my family for a day at Bluewood? And currently I'm like, yeah, this is absolutely worth it 100%, right? And but that's also because I come, like, if, like you say, like if I was to go to one of the bigger places and throw down $200 for a ticket, $300 for a lesson, and, you know, 75, 80, 100 bucks for rental gear. I mean, whatever the hell it is now, like it's just, it becomes asinine. And it's like, we're not there. And I don't think we're ever going to get there. But I'd like to play ball a little bit just with users.
Yeah, Pete, I think that's a good place to walk off. I've taken enough of your time today. You absolutely crushed it. I think anyone listening to this is going to want to check out this cool little spot out in the middle on this corner of Washington. So thank you so much, Pete, for your time, especially here as you're wrapping out the season. I know you have a lot of other stuff going on. So really, really appreciate it. Really appreciate you and wish you the best of luck at Bluewood in the future.
Thank you so much for having me. That was a lot of fun.
That's Pete Korfiadis, general manager of Bluewood, Washington. I'm telling you, that was an awesome surprise for me. I'd never met Pete, but I connected with Bluewood marketing director Will Weiss at the Snowvana Festival in Portland, Oregon last fall and pitched him on the show. He graciously connected me with Pete, who I thought showed up with incredible energy and enthusiasm. I love that conversation. That is a big, big vision for what is currently a pretty small-time operation, and that's one I will be watching closely. Thank you all so much for listening. Coincidentally, my next podcast will also focus on Washington State as I deliver a conversation with Mission Ridge CEO Josh Jorgensen. That one is already recorded, so look out for that soon. Pacific Northwest folks can also look forward to episodes with the leaders of a couple more places you've probably already skied and love, Cypress and Whistler, both in DC, obviously, both of which I have scheduled over the coming months. To get those episodes the moment they are live, please visit stormskiing.com and subscribe yourself to the Storm Skiing newsletter. New pods will appear in your email inbox several hours before syncing with key podcast services, including Apple and Spotify. There are free and paid tiers of the newsletter, and paid subscribers always receive podcasts 7 days before everyone else. You can also follow The Storm on the X platform and Instagram at Storm Ski Journal. Until next time, stay well, stay safe. I'm Stuart Winchester, and I'll talk to you again very soon.
The Storm Skiing Podcast is a Quicksilver Films production.